Okay, let's roll. Call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. Welcome, everyone. Today we are going to begin with a public hearing on Senate Bill 34A, and then we will deal with the other two bills. For those in the audience who are waiting breathlessly for Senate Bill 880 and Senate Bill 690, we will have some information about them, but we will not move the bills today. They'll be carried over till Tuesday. That by way of information. So right now I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 34A. Mezen.
Madam Chair, as a member of the committee, Senate Bill 34A comes to you from the Business and Transportation Committee, and what it was amended in that committee and became an A engrossed. And in its form as the A engrossed version, what it does, it allows the transit districts to increase the limit or the limit of the payroll tax that they have in statutes today, and it increases that from 7/10 to 8/10%. However, it also phases in that increase over a 10-year period, and each of those 10 years are still governed by the maximum of 0.2% maximum increase. So that is both on the payroll taxes and the self-employment tax. These taxes today are applicable to two districts within the state. That's TriMet in the metro Portland area, and Lane County on Lane Transit District. In your revenue impact statement, as you would see, this is an enabling legislation, which means it still has to be adopted and implemented over the number of years that it needs to do. However, in its final implementation, once that is done, we expect this bill to go in its revenue increase by up to $45 to $50 million a year in total, and that is based on what we have for collections today.
Thank you. And we have joining us today my good colleague from East Multnomah County and Clackamas County, maybe, Senator Monroe. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rod Monroe, Senate District 24. This feels like old home week. I feel very comfortable. The Revenue Committee, anybody want to trade me for a seat on Ways and Means?
Not in your life.
That's what I was afraid of. I have had a strong interest in transportation for many years, spent 12 years in the Metro Council, most of that time as the head transportation guy, the chair of JPAC. During my opportunity as at Metro, for 5 years, I led our complete delegation, county commissioners, mayors, et cetera, from the greater Portland region back to Washington, D.C. to lobby for transportation funding for projects, transit, bike, highway, all kinds of transportation projects. We were always very successful, as you know, because the fact that we had already made decisions about priorities of projects and didn't expect our congressional delegation to have to make those choices. We made them for them. And so in a bipartisan way, we always had complete support of the Oregon delegation for our projects, but with a warning, two warnings, actually. The first warning they always gave us was, you know, we can provide, in most cases, 60% funding for projects from the federal government, but you have to come up with the other 40%. And for the Portland, Oregon area region, the metro region, that was particularly difficult because of two things, that other cities and counties and states didn't have to deal with, because we had no sales tax, and most times the match for a transportation project in most states comes by a small tweaking of the sales tax to raise sometimes billions of dollars. The other thing is we have a constitutionally limited highway fund. Highway fund can only be used for highways in Oregon. Very few states have any such restriction. So we had to come up with a match from other sources. It was always very difficult. You know that the state has kicked in a couple times with some lottery bonding money, and there's been other ways to piece together money from universities, from counties, from cities, and from TriMet. The other warning that they gave us, and the one pertinent to Senate Bill 37, was we will not fund 34, sorry, Senate Bill 34, we will not fund, provide the match for your projects unless you can prove that when they're here, when they're online, when they're completed, you have money to operate it. And so Senate Bill 34 is not about today's crisis, and TriMet is facing a bit of a crisis today in that they operate based on the payroll tax. When payrolls are down, payroll taxes are down, and so they are in a mode right now to do some trimming, cut some services on weekends and so on because of the fact that their revenue is down. So this will not deal with that. Senate Bill 34 will not help with that. What Senate Bill 34 will do is to ensure that we can continue the pipeline of hundreds of millions and billions of federal dollars coming into this state in the years and years to come for additional transportation projects that are absolutely critical to the livability of this state and critical to jobs. And if we can't show that we can operate those lines by having appropriate revenues in reserve, then those hundreds of millions, billions of dollars will go to Dallas, Texas, or St. Louis, or someplace else instead of coming to Oregon. I think that would be a real shame in many ways, and not the least of which is building a transportation system that works, keeps goods and services flowing. Every time people use the MAX line, that frees up space on the freeways for trucks to get goods and services to the port and so on. So a transportation system, multifaceted transportation system, is critical. This bill will help ensure that in future years, TriMet will be able to continue, and Lane County Transit will be able to continue building a transportation system that meets the needs of all the people. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. Are there questions for Senator Monroe? Thank you very much for coming.
You bet.
Okay, we have signed up Fred Hansen, Marion Haynes, and Bob Shipwreck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Fred Hansen, General Manager of TriMet. Senate Bill S-34 is a part of the balanced transportation package. The other pieces are in various parts of the legislative process. This does specifically, as your committee administrator indicated, authorizes TriMet and the Lane Transit District to seek a future increase in the employer-paid payroll tax from under certain conditions. I'll come back to that in a little bit more detail. TriMet has had unprecedented ridership increases. In fact, on a per capita basis, which is really the best effective way to be able to think of it across the country, we rank the seventh highest per capita ridership in the United States. New York City, of course, number one, Chicago, others very high. But to have a medium-sized western city, relatively younger, is amazing. Second, with the high price of gasoline this past summer at $4, we saw not just our normal 3 and 4 or 5% increases per year over the previous year, but we were up in the teens, that is 13% levels of increase. And what is surprising is even with the drop-off in gasoline prices, many of those individuals have continued to be able to ride. And although there are some slippage in ridership, we are still seeing an increase year over year on a month-by-month basis as we compare it. For just a moment of background, across the United States, most transit properties are funded by sales tax. That is obviously not the case here in Oregon. When in the history of TriMet, in fact, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of the creation of TriMet, December 1st of this year. In 1969, when it was being created, regional business leaders came to the legislature to be able to establish that the authority for the Tri-County Metropolitan Transit District, and at that time also set the method of funding it, that is the payroll tax, and established the authority at 0.6%. The TriMet board is composed of 7 members appointed by the governor and confirmed by you, the Senate. It has always had a strong base within the business community as well as within the labor community, and has really been a very strong advocate on behalf of good, balanced transportation. TriMet's partnership with the business community continues and has really been made us one of the most successful in the country. And as you have as one of the attachments that are before you, a list of a number of businesses who are large payers of that payroll tax who have lent us their corporate logo to be able to indicate that they do want to and think this is a very important issue, as well as the attachment with 2 labor unions as well. Let me just speak to a moment on the mechanics of the legislation. Currently, payroll tax represents between 50% and 55% of the TriMet budget, operating budget, and roughly similar figures in LTD. The 2003 legislature authorized the first increase since 1969 in that payroll tax, and that was to move it from 0.6% to 0.7%. But before initiating an increase in that payroll tax, we, as required by the statute and as required by Senate Bill 34 in this case, were required to be able to seek economic expertise in evaluating whether or not the economy was such to be able to handle that increase. We employed 3 different economists, and we have the reports here if anybody is interested. But they were submitted by Randy Podzina from Eco Northwest, from Joe Courtright, Impressa, as well as from John Mitchell, M&H, at that time M&H Economic Consultants, but most of us remember him as the chief economist for U.S. Bank. What we have been able to do, and Senator Monroe mentioned this very briefly, but we've been able to use this ability to leverage federal dollars. The federal government, the Federal Transit Administration specifically, requires 3 things for any project that they fund. Number one is that it is a good project that will have high ridership. We meet that without any question whatsoever. Secondly, they require that there be the local match. They are funding and have funded for us generally at 60% of federal funds, for local 40%. We need to be able to have the local funds. We have been able to raise that and will continue to do so. Third, however, they require that there be 20 years projection of operating revenue, and that's what's so important about Senate Bill 34. It allows us to be able to show that we will have that operating revenue to be able to continue to be able to seek federal dollars. On average, over the last 2 decades, between 80 and 100 million per year have come to this region because of the ability for us to attract those federal dollars. And those are dollars that would go to other transit properties. This is a discretionary program. It is one that is competitively operated across the country. For example, I do want to be able to speak specifically to job creation. I think we all realize how critically that is at this time in the economy. The Green Line, which is the line that's being built from Clackamastown Center on up to Gateway, for those of you familiar with Portland, or along the Transit Mall, 2 different parts to it, a total of $350 million of federal money went into that project. It will open this September, creating over 7,500 jobs in the greater Portland metropolitan region. We think that's very important. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to testify, and certainly after the other testimony, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
Go ahead, Marian. Marian Haynes with the Oregon Business Association. We are here in support of Senate Bill 34 to increase the ability for local transit districts, give them authority to increase the payroll tax to fund transit operations. I think our interest in this is really threefold. One is that transit systems are an important part of helping capacity on the roadways and making sure that freight movement can occur by taking some of those cars, folks that can, that their trips are discretionary, that they can move, go on transit, and open up the roadways for those trips that really have to be on the roads, trucks and things of that nature. Second, employee commuting. It's been very successful and important for that, and that's one of the reasons that many businesses continue to be very active supporters of the transit system. And Fred mentioned the Green Line that's going in downtown Portland. Beyond the payroll tax, businesses stepped up through a local improvement district to help fund that project as well. So the support for these systems is really pretty overwhelming. And finally, transit does play a role in trying to help the state reach its greenhouse gas reduction goals. And we think that's an important component given that transportation is 30 to 40% of that, I believe. and then finally, I guess the last point is the issue of the ability to operate is very important. We're also supportive of a larger transportation package that hopefully will move this session. And it really just doesn't make any sense to expand the ability to increase capacity and then not be able to then operate that system. So with that being said, we very much support Senate Bill 34. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shipwreck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council, and it's my privilege today to come and speak in favor of Senate Bill 34. In our business, we have what TriMet is, and obviously a number of organizations are customers of ours. That's how we look at it. And it has been a very good relationship, I must tell you, and that's part of the reason I'm here. They have went out of their way to ensure that the finest contractors are selected. They have a real commitment to women and minority contractors, which we support. We want to nurture these people. They have a commitment to apprenticeship and training on their projects. And as a result of this commitment, over the years, they have developed a highly skilled workforce that continues to go back and work on their projects, which makes the light rail lines, streetcar, well, they don't do streetcars, light rail lines at least, some of the most cost-effective construction projects in the United States. On time and under budget is the byword for the use of these funds. So I just wanted to leave that with you. And we, as has already been mentioned, understand the need because of our circumstances to show the federal government that there is, in fact, a stream flow of dollars that will be available for these projects and operations. So we're strong supporters of this. Just a personal note, I'm just glad I'm just about 10 blocks away from the new line that'll work in, that'll open in September, and I can't wait to start using this light rail so I can now go downtown without a car, and I'm looking forward to it. I really am. Thank you.
Downtown is looking forward to it, too.
I can't wait to get there.
I want to commend all three of you for the spirit of partnership you've shown and for working together. You're more than the sum of your parts, and I think it really shows in what we've been able to accomplish. Mazin, did you have a comment?
I actually have a question, Madam Chair. In 1969, I just would like, Mr. Hansen mentioned that it's coming on the anniversary. Which month is that?
December 1st.
You know, December 1st.
Interesting. People who were born in the 70s and 80s think that this is 60s is ancient history.
That's right. December 1st is 2 days away from my birthday. I won't have trouble remembering that. Are there questions from the committee? Questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this? Committee, I'll just point you to the materials that were left on your desk. We have testimony in support of this bill from the Lane Transit District, the Oregon Transit Association, Chair Bryan of the Washington County Board of Commissioners, Thousand Friends of Oregon, Bob Stacey, and Danelle Cowan, Director of Community and Legislative Affairs for Clackamas County. So you'll find that in your packet. Okay, well, if there's no one else who wants to talk on this, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 34 and open a work session on Senate Bill 34. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt Senate Bill 34, with a due pass recommendation to the floor of the Senate.
Senator Morse has moved Senate Bill 34A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Telfer.
Has there been any data on the fact that the businesses will now have $50 million less to spend, and so it probably won't be absorbed. It'll be passed on to consumers. Any of their products and services, has anybody looked at the economic impact of that, the inflationary effects or the economic impact of that?
Of the payroll tax?
Yeah, it says $45 to $50 million a year in payroll taxes it will raise. So that's money out of a business's bottom line, and these days I don't think their margins are capable of absorbing that. And so that will be passed on to higher prices for either the product or the services that that company is providing.
Senator Telfer, the statutes as it is written, also as the A, allows this increase of, it is going from 0.7% to 0.8%. That's 14.3% increase in the tax. But that is phased over a 10-year period, and it has a limit. And I think probably because of previous studies, the limit of the increase cannot exceed 0.2% in 1 year. So over these 10 years, it cannot exceed. So it would have to be, if you spread it out over 10 years, it'll be 0.1% each year for 10 years.
Well, then, could you explain what this means? The measure can raise payroll taxes $45 to $50 million a year for the transit districts that has the authority to levy this tax spread over a number of years. But it says a year.
By the time it gets to the maximum where you can, where you have reached the 0.8%, that is the difference from what the 0.7% would be.
So I go back to my original question. Has anybody looked at the economic impact of this increased cost to businesses, employers, I should say?
I have not done that.
Senator Morris.
Related to that question, I would point out existing statute that's left unchanged on page 2, lines 8 through 11. The district board may not increase tax unless they make a finding regarding regional employment and income growth. And I read that to mean that they would not be consistent with existing statute in a declining economy of rising unemployment and reduced income growth to implement this tax. And I would ask maybe an interpretation of that, if that's an correct reading of that language.
That would seem to be the case. We can invite people back up if you want, or Mazin, do you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, I think this is the... that was a discussion at the time because of the current recession that we were locked in. I don't think this made it to the A engrossed version, though.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
It's actually on page 2, it's lines 8 law. Through 11.
It's existing law.
That's existing law.
Right.
So, but Fred, do you want to come back up here and see if you want to add any...
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The statute is very clear that to, as Senator Morris pointed out, that we must, in fact, have independent economic analysis that would allow us to make a finding, that is the TriMet board, that the income levels and employment levels can, in fact, support this. And, you know, as much as I'd like to be able to see that happen very quickly for the sake of all those people who are currently unemployed, it's hard for me to think that this happens earlier than as early as 2011, maybe even 2012. But the finding must be made that is it beforehand. As I indicated in my formal testimony, we utilize three different economists that I think are well known throughout the state to be able to advise us, in fact, if it would do the kind of damage to the economy that I think that that none of us would want to be able to see. And their findings were uniformly, no, it would not. We would expect to do that exact same thing under Senate Bill 34 as well. Again, let me stress is that it is a 0.1% increase to be phased in over 10 years. That is 0.01% per year on average for each of those 10 years. That would raise, in today's dollars, if it were put in place right now, 0.1% would be worth $3.2 million in the greater Portland metropolitan region. It is about 1/10 of that within the LTD area, the Lane Transit District. So it is not insignificant, but I didn't want to be able to leave the impression that at 45 or 50 million, at current dollars, it would be about 32 million. I assume that the projections forward are expecting that in somewhere in the 2022 or 2023 time frame, that with inflation and job growth, that number would be about that level. But that's at the end of that whole 10-year period, once beginning to be implemented.
Okay. Senator Telford, does that address your concern?
It addresses my concern. I come from, just a year ago, I was part of a committee in my district to study transit district and to put it before the voters. And we talked about payroll. This type of a system got huge pushback from the area, from particularly businesses. And, in fact, the voters defeated it when it wasn't even payroll taxes. So it just seems that we're always asking the business community to foot the bill for things. $45, $50 million also reduces tax revenues to the state, could be as much as $5 million. So, you know, I just don't think everybody's looked at it from a holistic point of view. And I won't be supporting the bill, but that's a lot of that's personal experience from just going through this process with my community and trying to develop a transit district.
All I would say is that obviously the decision must be made by individuals, but the business community, as is indicated in the logos that are there, as indicated by Marion Haynes earlier in terms of the Oregon Business Association, as well as the Portland Business Association, who nearly unanimously endorse this as well. The business community who is paying this, at least within the Portland region, thinks that it is a good investment, and they believe that that's very important.
Okay. And, committee, I also neglected to mention that we have a letter here in support from the mayor of Portland, too. And in the Lane Transit District, there was nobody here testifying on Lane Transit District, but are you aware of any business opposition down there?
I'm not aware of any. They certainly, Lane Transit District is a key part of being able to deliver the same type of services within the greater Eugene Springfield area, very important.
And Chair, are you referring to this letter from Lane, whereby the Eugene Chamber of Commerce and the Springfield Chamber of Commerce are both mutual? They're not necessarily supportive of it.
Okay, great. Yeah, I saw the letter and I didn't get a chance to read it, so thank you. Okay, thank you, Fred.
Thank you.
Okay, we are in discussion of Senate Bill 34. Is there any more discussion? Okay, Anna, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Senator Telfer?
No.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Burgess.
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 34 is on its way to the Senate floor, and Senator Metzger will carry this bill. Thank you all. Close the work session on Senate Bill 34 and open a work session on Senate Bill 880.
Are you 690? You're not 690. Are you 690?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you don't have anything new, but you've got something old, and I'll use that to kind of talk about what you're going to get. That's Senate Bill 880-2. We made another copy for you that should be in your packet. So I was the chair and vice chair yesterday met with us and Department of Revenue and went through the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 880. What I thought I would do is just go through real briefly with you what we have followed up and met with council this morning and what we've asked for, and would recommend that the chair carry this over to next Tuesday for a work session, and the amendment should be ready for you by then. And these were, we had Director Harchinko with us, and she helped work through this and the things that the department could be anticipated and their recommendations. The first one is on page 2, the last sub 6 of section 1. The determination was made that should be deleted because it really doesn't add anything. The department has contracting authority under current law, and there wasn't any need to change that. Under section 2, we did have a little bit broader interpretation of what tax programs may be eligible for the amnesty, and we scaled that back a little bit because of the time frame involved in the Dash 2 version, which would start on October 1. So if you look in Section 2, the programs that would be subject to the amnesty would be personal income tax in Chapter 316. That would exclude the withholding program. And as you've seen from tax compliance study the department did, we think about 98% to 99% of withholding is captured through collections. The main area is the other portions of the income tax return. 317 and 318 would be retained. 321, which is timber, would be deleted. The other thing that would be retained would be Chapter 118 under sub 3 there, which is the inheritance tax. The next one is the consumer portion of the tobacco taxes. 323.360 will be deleted just because there's been a lot of efforts in that area in the past. And then somewhat related to the bill you just heard, Section E is the transit tax, and we've asked that only the non-payroll portion, the portion of self-employed, be kept in that as part of the amnesty program. So in other words, it would be non-withholding personal income tax, corporate income, corporate excise, inheritance, and a portion of the transit tax that the Department of Revenue administers. Would all be subject to the amnesty. Other elements are on page 3, sub C there, line 4, this is a key policy change that was discussed but really didn't appear in the Dash 2, and we put it in the Dash 3, and that is that if you come forward and participate in the amnesty program, you'd be liable for all taxes that are past due, and the bill currently says, and interest, but that would be changed and to one-half interest otherwise due. So that gives you a little bit more of a carrot in terms of the participation in the program. And that shows up a couple of other places. For example, on page 4, there's a blank for the installment program. You sign up for an installment program, and then you pay an interest in that program, and it would also be one half of the existing rate, or the language we asked for is that would otherwise be due. So again, you pay partial interest.
We did make a slight modification on the end date for the installment agreements. On line 14, we changed that to May 31st, 2011. So the idea being that all of the collections would be captured within the 09-11 biennium. Also consistent with that change in section 3, line 16, we would add waive all applicable penalties and one-half interest otherwise due. So that's, again, part of that same policy decision. We had a lengthy discussion about section 4, which is the stick part of the program, which puts an additional 25% penalty for those who could have taken advantage of the amnesty program but did not. Talked with the department at length about, well, conditions when that may be waived. And then going back to the statute, the department currently has very a broad waiver capability now in the current law. So the decision was made that didn't need to change, that the department's current discretionary, if they felt that there was justifiable reasons why a taxpayer did not take advantage of the amnesty, and then they can waive that 25% penalty. So that's at the department's discretion, and that's the same as current law. So it would be treated as you do other penalties under current law. The next chunk of the bill is deleted. Section 7 is deleted. That's a remnant of the old 2005 bill. That's no longer relevant on retirement withholding, so that's gone. On page 8, the appropriation, section 9 is gone, was removed, and I'll describe in a minute what we've asked for in replacement. And given the time frame and given the kind of natural course of work that we would anticipate for the Senate and the House Interim Revenue Committees, we deleted the section 10 oversight so that it would be just part of your normal interim work that you would monitor this, that the department would come to you probably in September and would describe to you the marketing program they have and what their anticipation is and how they're gearing up for it. And then, of course, would report to you progress as it goes through. And then by the time the February session would come about, we should have a clear idea what the dollars that came in during that period are. That's gone through Section 11. Section 12 on page 10, the Tax Amnesty Fund, is retained so that these dollars will not go directly into the general fund. They will go into this separate amnesty fund. So the Ways and Means, this bill does have a subsequent to Ways and Means, so they could allocate those dollars. And there will be an additional sub 3 there. We had LFO in the meeting with us, and they recommended that what we do instead of an appropriation here is that have the Department of Revenue certify to the Emergency Board, or the Assembly, but it would probably be the Emergency Board, costs that are incurred in carrying out the amnesty program, and the department costs shall be reimbursed from the fund. Total costs reimbursed in this section shall not exceed $1 million. So they'll come before the e-board with certifiable costs, saying this is what we spend in terms of marketing, in terms of phone banks, in terms of processing the forms, and then those will be certified by the emergency board, and then that will come out of the gross fund for the amnesty program.
Okay, and with a $1 million cap.
Yes, the $1 million cap was recommended by LFO. We'll have further discussions with the department about an estimate of what they think at this point that number may look like. So what they would do, in other words, they would front their costs in the summer and through September gearing up for the program, and then they would reimburse themselves when that fund is determined and those costs are certified by the emergency board. So that's how the amendment will look. The other bit of information I have for you is I did get a little bit of time this past weekend, to a little bit of quiet time, to kind of purse through some of the other programs. And as you've talked about, there's been a lot of amnesty programs around the country. And in 05, when we did these estimates, I relied a lot on the Michigan 2002 study because it was very detailed on the participants. And I still have those numbers, but I also have some good detailed numbers from Iowa's 2007 estimates. And what they did was they broke out the personal and corporate income tax numbers by those that came from non-filers and those that came from amended returns, which is what you're allowing in this. You're not allowing the accounts receivable to participate in this. So I wanted to take all of that out. And then, of course, as economists do, we can make all kinds of proportions based on overall personal income, based on overall personal income tax collections, overall corporate income tax collections, and take those percentages and then scale them for Oregon's numbers. And what I get is a gross number of a little over $16 million in gross amnesty, 16.7. I went through and did some estimates on what we might get, and this is kind of a guess, but what we might get from new penalties of those that didn't participate, and new revenue out in the outer years from identified taxpayers. And the bottom line, my gross revenue estimate is a little over $17 million for 2009-11 and a little over $2 million for 2011-13 and 2013-15. Those numbers would, for the $17 million in 2009-11, would have to be reduced by the department's estimated costs. And I'll put that in your formal revenue impact statement that for next week. But I wanted to spend a little bit more time just getting my comfort level up with this estimate before I give you a formal statement on Tuesday. But that's probably, it'll probably look pretty close to that.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Paul. Senator Telfer.
Paul, that $17 million, I'm looking at the prior revenue statement of 12.9, but they were going to collect 3.2 under the current law. So is that $17 million for 2009-11, is that above and beyond a like amount for less assumed collections under current law?
This is strictly because of due to the amnesty.
Senator Telfer, yes, the biggest difference in this bill compared to the 2005 version is it includes corporate.
Okay.
That's the higher amount. I did make an estimate on what assumed collections would be about between 1.5 and 2 million per biennium.
Okay.
Under current law, what we would receive coming in based on that stream coming in.
In the out years.
Yes.
Okay.
Those would be the revenue that we would have got. They would have been people that participated in the amnesty that Department of Revenue would have tracked down. So it's a hypothetical number. It's a number that's relevant because that's the true comparison, is this law versus if this law didn't pass.
All right. Other questions for Paul? Senator Morris, does this comport with what?
Well, yes, but I've got some ideas I'd like to visit with you.
Okay. Shoot.
Thank you.
I don't think she heard the offline part.
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, offline. Okay, I missed that last part. I was waiting for some revelation.
Well, I often voice stupid things, but I'd like to at least think about this before I voice it. Okay.
Fair enough, Senator Morris. Okay. Any other questions or comments from the committee?
Any revelation due for you right now? I mean.
Okay. Well. We will, that's where we're heading with this. So, of course, the most important policy issue being to not include receivables in the amnesty program, which states have done it both ways. And obviously, if you include receivables, you would be getting more revenue in, but you would also be getting more money in that would be likely be collected under existing law, and giving up the penalties and interest from that revenue stream that you would otherwise have. So.
Yes, Madam Chair, I just follow up on that comment that Director Harchenko had a discussion with her counterpart in Indiana, who had conducted a similar one and did receive a fair amount of accounts receivable, but their at least his comments were that they, as a department, had not quote, worked those accounts receivables very extensively, and so they felt there were a lot of them out there that they wouldn't get under their current policies. And Deborah can comment on this, but the Department of Revenue told us that they felt that they had spent a lot of effort in trying to work those accounts in recent years, and you had a report on the delinquent account. So they're in the system. There's been a lot of resources committed to trying to get those collections up.
Okay. And Deborah is here. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Deborah?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan for the Department of Revenue. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer questions. There is only one item that I think might have been overlooked, and just for purposes of being clear, on page 2, section 2 of the dash 2 amendment, and I think this is a holdover from the original bill also, the tax years involved, I think, were going to change from 2009 to 2000.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And Deborah, we did request that in the request. So.
Thank you.
Did you get that, committee? The tax years that we're dealing with changed from 2009 to 2008.
Yes, and the reason for that is that you could have an extended returns that would fall into October of 2009 when this program is actually running.
And we are talking about non-filers, so.
Well, I haven't filed yet, so I was contemplating that.
Oh, confession time.
I'm on
finance and revenue. Yes, Senator Haas.
Last night I mailed out our amended 2007 returns because our accountant made a mistake. And I thought about this bill and kind of a pause as I dropped it into the slot. But, you know, there's going to be some interest. Yeah, I thought maybe I should wait a few months.
But you didn't, did you, Senator Haas? You did the right thing for yourself and the state of Oregon, didn't you?
Slept well last night, though.
Yeah, this is called the Sleep Tight Bill.
Yes.
Okay, anything else to add? Other questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Deborah. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 880 and open a work session on Senate Bill 690. And again, this is just for the purposes of updating us on where we stand, because this, along with 880, will be carried over till Tuesday.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you had in your packet a dash one amendment to Senate Bill 690. And as you recall, this is the bill that was born out of the Department of Revenue's compliance study, and they had a number of recommendations on tools that they could use to improve compliance. The dash one amendment does three things. It pares back what was in the drafted bill, and the three things it does is it deletes section 2 of the bill, which is the provision that would have allowed the Department of Revenue to request occupational license suspensions earlier in the collections process, so that's being deleted. And then the data matching piece in section 8 is also deleted.
And that's on page
of the bill, it is on page
8.
Okay. Yeah, so those are the two large pieces that get deleted. Mm-hmm. The other change it makes is to section 9 of the bill. There's some language change in there on lines 40 through 43 of page 8, and section 9 is the section of the bill that would allow them to report information to consumer reporting agencies. And basically what the changes do is it transfers rulemaking authority from the Department of Justice to the Department of Revenue and makes the language permissive. So line 43, the shall becomes may. And it also deletes on line 41, there's language that refers to whether or not a taxpayer has neglected or refused to file any return or pay any tax. The language referring to the return is deleted, so it's limited to a taxpayer who has neglected or refused to pay any tax or has not filed in good faith a petition contesting the tax. Then the department may report such information to the consumer reporting agency. So that's what the dash ones do. They make those deletions for the most part.
Okay. Yep. Refresh me again on the. That's right, because we're only after taxpayers who, on the credit reporting, who neglect or refuse to pay any tax.
Correct, Madam Chair.
All right.
And
then all of the other components are unchanged. All of the other language in the dash one is just changing reference numbers, subsection numbers.
So basically, committee, we took out a couple of tools that need more work or maybe more review. The data match issue raises some issues, and that is where the Department of Revenue coordinates information with banks to find out what bank accounts people have. There's a lot of nervousness around this issue regarding privacy and also burdens being imposed on banks. And then the licensing provisions, the department already has authority on licensing boards, but not as early in the process as this bill would allow them to have. So we took a buy on that for the time being. But we did, as you'll recall, Representative Smith came and advocated very strongly for reporting to credit reporting agencies, because sometimes when people owe taxes and leave the state, there's really no credible way to get the money back. And yet if it's reported to a credit reporting agency and that person over in the state of Maryland tries to get a home loan, then sometimes it gets their attention when the lender says, not till you clear up this ding on your credit report. So we thought that was a constructive tool to encourage the department to use. So do we have any questions for Chris? Comments? Okay, everybody loves it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
I haven't read. Molded over now.
Just kidding.
Things are moving along here. Could we have the reading of Section 9 as amended, line 41, or 40, 41, 42, and 43? How would that sentence then read?
Okay.
Sure, Senator Morris. Starting with line 40, notwithstanding ORS 314.840 and subject to rules established by the Department of Revenue, if a taxpayer has neglected or refused to pay any tax and has not filed in good faith a petition before the department contesting the tax, the department may.
Okay.
And actually, there's another small tweak on that. It's actually notwithstanding ORS 314.835. That was a correction that was made in our by some sharp eyes in our work session on this, work group on this. You see what I'm saying, Chris? On line 40, that where it says 314.840, it should be 314.835.
I'll mention that to Elsie. That's not in the dash one.
It's not in the dash one, but
right, yeah.
But we're
I'll make note of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
I had understood Chris's previous presentation on the amendment that it addressed the words neglected or refused in line 41. So that was what was behind my question. But you're saying those remain, those words remain.
Well, but the phrase about neglecting or refuse to file any return, that's deleted. So it's only if they neglect or refuse to pay. Am I correct, Chris?
Correct. The words neglected or refused stay in.
Okay.
According to the dash ones. What gets deleted are the reference to a return. So it would read, if a taxpayer has neglected or refused to pay any tax.
Okay. Gotcha.
So basically, we don't report to the credit bureaus non-filers. We report tax delinquencies.
Right.
Senator Tilford.
Thank you. When we say neglect, we're talking about willful neglect, not inadvertent.
I thought we
mailed it in.
That's how I would interpret neglect. I don't know if that's
willful.
There's some legal interpretation there. I can check with Ledge Counsel on
separated. Both spouses signed it. One thought the other one sent it in, and they didn't.
Right.
So we're really looking at willful.
That's my read on it. I can confirm with Ledge Counsel if the legal interpretation of that is the same.
That would be helpful, because I know, there's a lot of times where you're doing divorce, couples going through a divorce, they're capable of filing jointly until the divorce is final. They do, but sometimes the other spouse
for yes.
Madam Chair, this does raise an interesting point because you have the issue of omission or commission. Mm-hmm. And neglected could be omission. Mm-hmm. Refused really is commission. And maybe the purposes would be better served to strike neglected.
Well, but on the other hand, if someone, if they're going through that same divorce and someone forgets to pay the mortgage, you can bet that that's going to show up on the credit report. Correct?
May not. I mean, it may be that they get noticed before it affects their credit. Mm-hmm. The other one.
Deborah, will you come back up
forward
here and let us know what the process is for informing someone who has forgotten it or whatever, and how this would be interpreted?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. I believe the language is modeled on what is in the license suspension statute now, and that appears on page 2 of the original bill. And it's if the department determines that any licensee or provider has neglected or refused to file any return or to pay any tax. But our process is to ask for payment. If there's a delinquent tax, we ask for payment. We demand payment. And if that payment isn't forthcoming, then that would become a delinquent tax that would be subject to reporting.
Would that count as refusing to pay tax? If you informed them and they still didn't pay, would that count as refusing?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Then maybe we could take neglect out because...
because it also says or to pay any tax. So it's one or the other, could be neglect or failed to
or
pay a tax.
No, neglected or refused
no,
to
keep
pay,
going.
Pay any tax.
File it or to pay any tax. I don't want to nitpick. I just know I've been involved with numerous reality cases where, particularly when you've got couples who no longer live together but are filing jointly, one moves, the DOR may contact that address. They've not left a forwarding address. The unsuspecting spouse, maybe 2 years down the line before they're notified that this tax return was never filed or this tax was never paid, and then all of a sudden they're stuck paying it because of the joint filing. And, you know, it's just trying to protect those situations where, and it was inadvertent. It wasn't willful neglect.
Okay. We have somebody in the audience back there who's looking very eager to share some knowledge. Welcome, Mr. Marquis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of TransUnion, who would be receiving these reports if the reports were made. I just wanted to point out that if you look on page 9, there's a whole notice procedure that the department would have to embark upon with the taxpayer before anything could be reported to a consumer reporting agency, starting on line 3, that the department shall provide advance notice to the taxpayer. So they would have adequate notice that...
Assuming the address is current. And it would be interesting to find from the department how often somebody moves in between filing...
Do other people who report to TransUnion, do they have some kind of a certified mail requirement that would be appropriate here? Or,
Madam Chair, there's no such requirement in statute for private sector accounts. Mm-hmm. I would leave that to the committee whether that's appropriate here. I would say that I might be a little concerned with the use of the word refused by itself, because if that might be later interpreted that somebody that in a court of law that the taxpayer had to say no, I ain't paying, whereas oftentimes these things are simply won't respond to letters or calls.
Okay, well, maybe the solution to this then is to just incorporate in on page 8, section 2A, starting at line 40, where if a taxpayer has neglected after being notified or refused, to kind of incorporate that notification in there, and which may not even be necessary since it does occur later. But I assume you'll be available to help us make this make sense.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to help any way I could.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, yeah, because I concur. I mean, we need to, but I also know the Department of Revenue only knows where a person lives based on their tax return filing. And sometimes when you're auditing or whatever, it's 2 years down the line when you finally, get around to looking at a return in many cases. And so, or the IRS has done something. And that person has moved on. They didn't file an interim tax return, so you don't know what their current address is. So there are times where taxpayers are not notified that they owe this tax. And it's not willful or refusal. They just didn't know they either owed or had not filed.
Madam Chair, Senator Telford, that is an issue, and the law does anticipate that happening by providing that if we mail it to the last known address, then we have satisfied the notice requirements. And that may be the return that was filed 2 years ago if they have not notified us of an updated address.
So if the letter doesn't come back to you, you assume it got to them?
Madam Chair, I believe we have met the statutory requirements for notice if we send it to the last known address, and that's defined in the statutes as whatever was on the last return filed with us. Mm-hmm. So the taxpayer does have an obligation to notify us if they move in order to receive that mail, or if they have a forwarding address in place with the post office, of course, it would be forwarded. But
don't they already know they owe the money?
Not if you audit them.
In some cases, some people may file a return and not send payment with it. They know that they owe the money. If we adjust the return and increase the tax, we send them a notice of deficiency. We're going to send that to the address on the return. That typically takes place within a few months of filing. Mm-hmm. If we audit the return, then we're going to be asking the taxpayer for additional information, generally. So we need to contact the taxpayer, and we should have an updated address at that point. What may happen is we'll receive reports from the IRS that are, in fact, 2 years after the return was filed. We send those. Those would go to the last known address. That might be a two-year-old address. But if the taxpayer hasn't notified us of a new address, we've met the legal requirement of notifying the taxpayer.
Okay, so for TransUnion, if someone ends up getting, say they're in the situation that Senator Telfer is talking about, and they end up getting reported to the credit bureau, and it reduces their credit rating, and they clear it up, how long does it take for their credit rating to recover?
Madam Chair, that I think that's going to depend on the factual situation, and may be different for each individual debtor. There is, however, under the Fair Credit Reporting Act that we all operate under federal law, there is a mechanism for any debtor or any consumer, say, who feels they have something in error on their credit report to file with the credit reporting agency, and then that goes back to whoever placed that on the credit report, and they have 30 days to respond and either take it off or show justification why it should be on. So there is a process under federal law after the fact, however, that's after it's reported.
And in the course of that happening, would the Department of Revenue learn the address of the person who was challenging the item?
I'm most assuredly they would, Madam
And
Chair.
If they did work it out right then, would it just come off the credit report, no harm, no foul?
That would be up to the Department of Revenue. Remember that a credit reporting agency is not allowed under the Fair Credit Reporting Act to either place or remove anything from a consumer's credit report. All of that, they only put it on the report or take it off at the request of a creditor. And so they're prohibited from just taking it off themselves once a creditor has placed it on. So it could, at that point, the Department of Revenue could take it off entirely, or they could ask that it be shown as a paid collection.
So if we put some language in here requiring the Department of Revenue to report back to the credit agency within 30 days of satisfaction of a debt, then that would be the mechanism?
Certainly. I don't see a particular problem with that.
Deborah,
from our standpoint, I don't know about the Department of Revenue.
Because we really don't have a mechanism in this bill for the responsibility of the Department of Revenue to let the credit agency know that the debt's been satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Deborah, do you have any thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, I need to think about that a little bit further. I don't know what the standard operating procedure is for.
If it would be helpful, Madam Chair, I could actually put the department in touch with somebody in Chicago in our headquarters who would be an expert in that.
That would be very helpful.
Could maybe help us through that.
Yeah. We would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I really do think this is a valuable tool.
Senator Morris?
We can probably just pound this thing to death.
My question focuses on the May reporting. And the question is, if you have an account receivable that is they're meeting the workout that you've agreed to on a payment plan, would they be then reported to the credit consumer report agency?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I don't believe they would because they are in compliance with a department-approved payment plan, so we would not consider that to be a delinquent debt in the sense that I believe this is intended to be.
Well, thank you for that clarification because I think it's a very important point. If you have somebody that's had financial stress, they're compliant, but they just don't have the means and you're in a workout, and then all of a sudden you throw them into another category. That would be damaging to them. I think it's important that they not be in that.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morris, oftentimes in the private sector, creditors use that very thing as a tool with consumers in those kinds of workout arrangements so that they make it very clear with the consumer that as long as you're making payments, we're not going to report this. But if you fall off the program that we've established, we will. And that really has some effect in helping people stay with the program.
That would be a tool that I assume you could do by rule, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes.
No. Okay. Thank you.
Let me give you an example. I want to fix this, but I'll give you an example, and we're going to see probably a lot of it right now. Somebody files a tax return. They move out of the state. They're not going to file another Oregon tax return, so you don't get advised of the change of address. You modify the return. Send a notice. You don't know where the notice goes. It doesn't necessarily get returned to you. They've not left a forwarding address or whatever. The time period has moved beyond that. The person is never notified that they owe additional tax, and now all of a sudden they're being reported to a collection agency. So I'm just trying to figure out a way to, and these are legitimate. This is neglect, maybe, but not willful. They moved out of the state. They were not going to file another Form 40, and so you would not have found out about a new address. And that happens a lot. So I'm just trying to find a way to work that in here so that somebody isn't penalized because there was no requirement to notify the Department of Revenue that they had moved and have a new address.
Well, but under what Mr. Marquis just said, if they find this ding on their credit rating under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, they have the ability to challenge that, and in the course of that, they get connected with the Department of Revenue, and then the Department of Revenue can let TransUnion know that needs to come off of the credit report, that the people...
Well, they do, in fact, owe the tax. and but yeah. They didn't know it. And, you know, sounds good in conversation, but I can tell you notices that fly back and forth between the Department of Revenue and taxpayers aren't always timely, correct, et cetera, et cetera. It's just another cog in the wheel here.
Well, let's see if we can work out something to, you know, to provide protection. I don't think we can ask the Department of Revenue to hire a private investigator to
again, it's this neglect versus willful, or, you know, willful. It's just...
Well, we could put a certified, we could, for cases where there's no response from the taxpayer. In other words, they could notify the taxpayer, and if they haven't heard from them for 30 days,
the IRS does that.
Then they could put a certified letter requirement in, and then, you know, do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
That way, we wouldn't be giving up the tool,
mm-hmm. But
we would be
unless you know it got delivered or not. Get that little green card back.
Yeah. Yeah, so see, play around with that and see if that might work. We don't want to require certified for everybody because of the fiscal.
Right.
But you know, in those cases where somebody can't be reached, it might be a good thing to have, a good tool to have.
Thank you,
Mr. Marquis. Any other comments? Okay. Good discussion. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 690 and we will bring it back on next Tuesday. And committee, I can't believe we're doing this again, but we have Monday off.
Huh.
With that, we are adjourned.